Judiciary Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We have a couple of public hearings today and some work sessions scheduled. I think we'll start off by opening a work session on Senate Bill 63.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 63 comes from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and authorizes the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to deny application for training as public safety officer. You will have the dash two amendments in front of you, which were before the committee, which here as a result of some issues that arose at the last committee meeting on this bill, are more on the lines of grammatical than issues. Well, now after crime and insert or violation, and crime or insert and violation.
Okay.
Excuse me.
No.
And then we also have the dash one amendments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That
Mr. Chair, did she change sections again?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
I wear high heels and everything. Doesn't do any good.
Sorry. Have a dash one.
You know, we're very sensitive to that.
Actually, the dash ones, we had thought about the dash ones in a grammatical sense on a comment from Senator Whipsett, and it turns out that that would cause legal problems that we didn't want to cause, so we abandoned the dash one. Amendments. So, and this is a pretty straightforward bill. It didn't have any opposition to it. And so at this point, since my honorable vice chair is absent today, I was wondering if Senator Beyer might have a motion on the dash two amendments.
Move the dash two amendments in the bill, Madam Chairperson.
Senator Beyer has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 63. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Move the bill as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation, Madam Chairperson.
The Honorable Senator He-Man Beyer has moved the Senate Bill 63 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Objection, so ordered. I will carry that bill. Thank you. Done. Next.
We have amendments to that one, too. Yeah, just in discussion.
There's too much paperwork here.
What? Here,
okay, next we will open a work session on Senate Bill 287. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill
287. No.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm sorry. I'm going back to Pendleton if this keeps up.
You spent too much time in Pendleton. That's the problem.
This bill relates to the Crawford case and would create an exception to the hearsay rule, which would allow hearsay statements in if the person against whom they're being offered, the defendant, participated in wrongdoing. You have the original Bill 287 plus the dash two amendments, and we have several people, Peter Gotland, Kelly Skye, Tim Sylvester, Tom Reniger, who are all here and would like to talk about the bill, as would Sybil Hebb. What it really comes down to is between the dash two amendments and the bill as originally drafted. The bill as originally drafted is modeled on the federal rule and comes to you from Senator Walker and Tom Reniger. And the dash two amendments are from Tim Sylvester, and Tom Reniger likes those too. So it's best to have them all come up and give you a reason for why it should be the original bill as opposed to the dash two.
Thank you. Maybe we could get Mr. Leninger and Kelly Skye to be sure to be up here as we talk about this. Here we are. Midian, is this? Okay, all right.
Good Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Leininger. I'm a law professor at the University of Oregon, although I'm here today on my own behalf and not expressing an official position of the law school.
Are you sick, Madam Chair?
I'm a little bit sick. I apologize.
Your voice doesn't sound the same, Tom.
I apologize. I'm fighting a cold. We went up and saw the Duck women have a great victory on Saturday in Washington. Cheered a little too much. I apologize for that. As you recall, I believe most of the committee was here today. Many of us appeared before with a proposal to include in our state evidence code, which is modeled almost entirely after the federal evidence code, a version that was identical at that time to a 1997 amendment to the federal evidence code. The basic problem is that someone who wrongfully procures the unavailability of a witness, perhaps by a threat, perhaps by enticement, perhaps by a bribe, anyone who wrongfully causes a witness to be gone at trial shouldn't profit from the hearsay rules. And states that adopted the federal rules of evidence have, in 1975, as we did thereabout, have thereafter adopted some later amendments, including this 1997 amendment. You'll recall Senator Pruzanski had a very important suggestion to widen the scope of that amendment to reach activity that may not have been intended to cause unavailability, but in his judgment, in the narrow case of a murder, if one could prove to a judge pretrial that the accused had murdered, at least by preponderance of the evidence appeared to have murdered the declarant, then that accused shouldn't be able to profit from the hearsay rules. And so I think when we left that day, our task was to go back and modify the proposal, 287, to address Senator Pruzanski's concern. Since that time, Mr. Sylvester has visited with some of the DAs and others who are interested in the practical usefulness of this bill, and he came up with some ideas that I think are sensible, as well as the original proposal that Senator Walker and I submitted. And I don't have a strong feeling. I think that the first proposal presents simplicity. It mirrors a federal provision that's been interpreted by federal courts since 1997. On the other hand, the federal version may not be as useful in state court to prosecutors because federal criminal law is often more about organized crime, about a certain scale of crime where people perhaps more commonly with intent to cause witnesses to be unavailable, give them cement shoes or bribe them with a bus ticket out of town. Whereas I think a more common occurrence in state court is perhaps for the accused to cause a crime knowingly, which incidentally causes unavailability. So I guess with that I might just respectfully submit to the chairs and the members of the committee that either the original 287 or the Dash 2 amendments seem to achieve the original purpose for which I hope to submit that original proposal, which was just to make sure no one in the state of Oregon can profit from causing the unavailability of a witness against him or her. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Sylvester from the Department of Justice. I wanted to explain what we were trying to do with the Dash 2 amendments. There were three problems that I was trying to correct by the language that's before you. The first is that the federal rule of evidence uses the term acquiesce, who has engaged or acquiesced in, and there was some concern about that particular word being too broad. And so one of the Dash 2 amendments has changed that to who committed, directed, or otherwise participated in as a way of clarifying and perhaps narrowing a bit the scope of acquiesce. The second is that the federal rule contains the word wrongdoing and says who engaged or acquiesced in wrongdoing. And there was some concern about that word being too vague or ambiguous and creating problems in the future as far as implementation of the rule. And so what we did was to provide specifically on Dash 2 that engaged in criminal conduct, and there would be very specific in a usual case what criminal conduct means. And the other part is to a certain extent, to eliminate the requirement of having to show what we call specific intent in the situation where the bad act is actually criminal conduct. And what I mean by specific intent is that the federal rule says that the person engaged or acquiesced in wrongdoing that was intended to make the witness declarant unavailable as a witness. There is a practical matter for prosecutors in a criminal case to prove that the defendant intended by the criminal conduct to make the witness unavailable may be an almost impossible showing in many cases. Even, for example, in a homicide case where the defendant murdered or caused the death of the victim or the declarant, it may be almost impossible to prove that the person did that with the intent of rendering the person unavailable as a witness. For example, the person may have intended simply to make that person dead and not to render him unavailable as a witness. It also creates a problem in circumstances in which the person engages in criminal conduct that does not cause the person's death, but merely causes the person to be incompetent or incapacitated. And I'll use a real-world example of a case that we had in our office recently. And that was an elder abuse situation in which the person engaged in a series of acts and omissions, including maltreatment of the person, not giving him his medication that was prescribed for him, and not feeding him, etc. And as a result, the victim in that case gradually became incompetent. He could not testify because his medications had resulted in him becoming mentally disabled. As a result, that person no longer could be a witness against the defendant. But we would find almost impossible in that case to prove that the defendant engaged in that course of conduct in order to render the victim incompetent. Rather, the person was doing that in order to steal the financial assets from the victim. And so in those situations in which the person engages in a course of conduct that renders the person incompetent or otherwise incapacitated, it's our view that that should be enough to constitute forfeiture without the state requiring the specific intent that the person did it, requiring the state to prove that the person engaged in that conduct for the specific intent of rendering the person incompetent. And so that's the reason why in the first clause of this draft, there's no requirement that the proponent of the evidence show that the defendant or the adverse party engaged in the conduct with a specific intent. Rather, all we have to show is, number one, that he engaged in criminal conduct, and two, that criminal conduct caused the person to be unavailable. Now, with the second clause there, if the conduct is not of itself criminal, we would have to show, number one, that it was wrongful in one sense, and number two, that it was engaged in for the specific purpose of causing the declarant to be unavailable. And an example I might give of that is that you often have a domestic violence situation in which the victim of the domestic violence becomes a reluctant witness. If the defendant makes it possible through, lending her his car, makes it possible for the victim to leave the state and thereby avoid subpoena, that may not necessarily be criminal conduct, and so it wouldn't fall under the first clause, but it would be, we submit, wrongful conduct, but we would have to show that the defendant did that with a specific intent of making the declarant become unavailable. And so that is a situation where I think the state should be, or the proponent of the evidence should be required to show a specific intent, and that's what this particular bill does.
Okay.
Any
questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Your last hypothetical, I guess, was interesting to me in that it raised how you define cause. I mean, you're saying that if in that case the potential defendant or the defendant gave his car keys to the abuse victim and that allowed the person to evade subpoena, then that caused the declarant to be unavailable.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Ringo, that would be the requirement that the state would have to show that conduct, in fact, did cause the declarant to be unavailable. Now, the defendant in that case may be able to say, I wasn't the cause of it. It was her own intentional conduct, that is, leaving the state, that resulted in her not being available, and so I didn't cause it. But that is an issue that would have to be litigated under the cause particular clause.
Yes. May I also offer an answer, Senator Ringo? Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Ringo, I look closely at the language that Mr. Sylvester has proposed. It seems to have two tracks. One track would be for conduct that itself is a crime, and I think your hypothetical would not amount to a crime unless it was deliberate inducement not to testify. The second track would be if there is conduct that not only causes unavailability but is also intrinsically wrongful. That qualifier wrongdoing was very important to me because I feared the situation you discussed would render this proposal too expansive. So the only way that conduct might fit in the statute would be either if it's a crime or if for some other reason it's intrinsically wrongful, and I think what you described wouldn't meet those requirements unless
it would not
unless it were accompanied by some statement, you can have my car if you disappear for a year and don't go to trial, but merely providing the means for a witness to hide, I think unless it's intrinsically wrongful wouldn't satisfy the requirements. It's sort of an equitable doctrine that you can't on the one hand make someone disappear and on the other hand say, well, where is she? And it's that simple concept. It's just, that's why I kind of feel these are fine-tuning details, because I think when a court gets this doctrine, they'll say, well, has Oregon joined the wave of states that recognize this equitable concept? Then it becomes almost just a common sense determination. Does this accused come to us with unclean hands, trying to keep away a witness?
Is there a definition of the word wrongful?
Is it wrongdoing or wrongful?
It's wrongful. Well, in the dash twos, it says wrongful.
It just says wrongful.
What does that mean?
That, I guess, is just going to have to be decided on a case-by-case basis, or if the committee wants, we could. To the extent that it is contrasted to the first clause with criminal conduct, wrongful then means something that is not of itself criminal. But there is a body of case law under the federal rule in interpreting the term wrongdoing in the federal rule, where I think the federal courts have, and then Professor Reininger can correct me if I'm wrong, have construed wrongful to be conduct that is that prejudices justice in the sense that the person is engaging in some conduct in order, and it does require that the state show or the proponent of evidence show that the purpose was to make the witness unavailable. And so wrongful in that situation is, well, I'll give you an example. Suppose that the defendant is charged with beating his wife, and one of the witnesses is a child. And the defendant gives the child some money in order to go on a trip to Europe. And it just so happens that the trip to Europe is during the course of the trial. That would not of itself be wrongful because it's entirely lawful and permissible for a father to give money to his child in order that she can go on a trip. But if it is done with the specific intent that the child will be unavailable and with the purpose of rendering that child unavailable as a witness at trial, at that point it does become wrongful.
Madam Chair? Well, maybe we'll get clarification. I don't know what the word wrongful adds to it then. I mean, to me it sounds like you could say it was intended to cause the clearant to be unavailable and did cause. I don't know what wrongful gets you.
Well, in that situation,
I guess to flip it around, give me a hypothetical where the conduct was intended to make the witness unavailable, but it wasn't wrongful. Give me that example.
Well, a good example for that, Senator Ringo, is a situation where the victim is the wife of the defendant. It's a spousal abuse situation, and the defendant at trial asserts the husband-wife privilege to prevent the wife from testifying against him. That is conduct that has the specific intent to render the witness unavailable, but it is not wrongful in the sense that is a legitimate exercise of a privilege that is recognized under the evidence code. And so that, I suppose, is a good example of that.
Yeah, well, I agree that in the word wrongful doesn't add much to this because it could be any other conduct because it was the intent that determines it, not the right or wrongness of it. Counsel?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is probably the crux of the whole issue of wrongdoing and what wrongful is. The Crawford case cites a 1878 case of Reynolds versus the United States. It was an interesting case. It was a bigamy case out of Utah, and it was a situation where the second wife had received a subpoena in the wrong name, and had appeared at an original proceeding where there was a possibility of being under oath and testimony. And then the second time was they were unable to locate her because it appeared that the husband, whatever, was making sure that she didn't appear in court. And that's what cited for wrongdoing in that case. She was under subpoena to be at the second proceeding. So she was under court order to be there. So and it goes back, and it in turn cites a whole series of cases from England. And it's in the federal rules. When I looked at it, I couldn't find too much as to what the term meant. I couldn't find any cases. So I think in many regards, it's up for being fleshed out either by the legislature or by the courts.
Well, and thank you for providing that historical insight. I guess my problem with the amendment overall is it kind of blurs the conduct that is involved in the actual offense. Mm-hmm. In many cases, and it would seem to me that you have to be really clear that you're not talking about the original offense, that you're talking about subsequent. But maybe I'm prejudging some of the comments that will come later, so maybe we'll move on to Ms. Guy. Who wants to go next from the defense? Mr. Leininger, did you
want to? If it's appropriate, Madam Chair, I was interested in responding to that last point, which is a very sensible point, and it was a point on which a group of law professors presented an amicus brief in the Supreme Court case, the Crawford case, and they took the position, and the court appeared to endorse the position, although not explicitly, but in adopting virtually all the arguments made by these law professors, seemed not to be troubled by the idea that the very conduct that is at issue in a prosecution could also be the basis for the finding of forfeiture by wrongdoing. And I noticed that Senator Prezonsky is here, and I think he pointed out the other day a hypothetical that was troubling to me. If one doesn't allow the underlying conduct to be the basis for forfeiture, then if a person commits murder and the victim didn't die initially but had made statements maybe more than 24 hours later to the police officer, so they're not really admissible under separate exception, but then the victim were to perish, if it were possible to avoid forfeiture by saying, wait a second, that's the very offense for which I'm charged, you couldn't find forfeiture on the ground that I've committed the crime for which I'm charged.
Right, I got it.
Then the fear would be that those people who killed or incapacitated the declarant might profit. And I think there are quite a few nuances here, and I'm still wrestling with some of them, but what makes this easiest for me to understand and why I think so many states in the federal system have adopted it is just boils down to that common sense notion that someone who caused the witness not to come to court shouldn't be allowed to protest that the witness is absent. And the lead law professor from the University of Michigan who presented this case to the Supreme Court in the amicus briefs said it's sort of like the definition of chutzpah, I think, to follow his analogy. The person who throws himself upon the mercy of the court and says, but I am an orphan, well, you find out he killed his own parents. You know, there's just no sense in granting some sort of special treatment for someone who caused the predicament of which he now complains. And I think both of these amendments, or the original language or the amendment, would allow that conclusion by court.
If I could offer one additional example, and it's a common one, and that is sexual abuse of a child, repeated sexual abuse in which the defendant tells the victim, don't tell anybody or I will kill you, or I will kill your parents or your mother or something of that nature. And so the child not only is victimized by the crime, but at the same time is rendered incompetent because the child becomes unavailable as a witness simply by the fear that he will carry out the threat. And so there has generally been no concern, at least under the federal rules or in the other states, that the very conduct that is being prosecuted is also the conduct on which the state is relying to say that the defendant has engaged in conduct to render the victim, the declarant, unavailable as a witness. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Skye, you look like you're ready to talk.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm here today taking a different position than I did at the last hearing on Senate Bill 287, and that is that I now support Professor Leininger's initial language in Senate Bill 287, and that is the language straight from the Federal Rules of Evidence. It's a good, safe, cautious approach. It comes with a body of case law. It's already been litigated, and so it's a safe approach for us to take. I think it's important to sort of step back and remember why we're here. And we're here because before the Crawford case, trial courts were admitting statements in violation of the Confrontation Clause. And they were doing that based on our statutory rules, the primary rule being the DV exception. And that is a situation where the prosecutors came to you and said, we need this exception because we need these statements in order to prosecute these cases. And those statements were then, and those were complaints made within 24 hours by a victim of domestic violence. It took quite a few years and a lot of litigation and overturned cases for the Supreme Court to tell us that that was an unconstitutional approach. So now, now Professor Leininger brings to you a doctrine that's already been accepted. It's used under the federal rules. It's been declared constitutional. It's referred to by Justice Scalia in the Crawford case, and brings you that language, which we know is safe language. That should be the approach that you take. Any broader approach, any attempt to redefine our previous exceptions in order to allow statements in for particular examples given here, you risk the same result that you had from passing the DV exception in the first place. And so that is why I now support a bill that I previously told you was not necessary. And, you know, this doctrine is available at common law now. I don't think anybody disagrees that that Justice Scalia referred to it in the Crawford opinion. It's available at common law. I think the desire is to put it in the evidentiary code so that prosecutors are sort of cued into the fact that it exists, that they can get it in by statute. They know that under this statute it's most likely going to be constitutional. If we broaden the approach that we take, we basically throw the cautious approach out. Couple things. By, you know, our primary concern is that of whether prosecutors are going to come in and say that the underlying offense for which the person is on trial is the offense that is the wrongdoing and that waived their confrontation rights. And I disagree that that can be the case in every prosecution, because then what you've done is you've wiped away the Confrontation Clause. Anytime somebody assaults another person, they're thereby creating a right to confrontation because they've committed an offense that gives them constitutional rights, and they're simultaneously waiving it because they've actually committed criminal conduct. And if the person doesn't show up in court, the prosecutor argues, well, they didn't show up in court because they're scared because this person assaulted them. You have completely eliminated the Confrontation Clause. You're writing it out. Now, the examples that are given and where I would concede that there may be an exception is homicide, and that's what we talked about at the last hearing. When a person is killed, I would say that under the federal rule, it's hard for someone to say, well, I didn't kill them intending for them not to be available. If you kill somebody, you're intending them for not to be available to do anything, you know, eat dinner, let alone testify in court. So that's hard for me to see how that argument is going to get anywhere in court. If you have the intent to kill, you have the intent to make that person unavailable as a witness. The second example that Mr. Sylvester gave as to sex abuse and the statement, don't tell, you know, or it will have consequences, that is the wrongful conduct. It's not illegal to tell somebody not to do something, but that is wrongdoing. That's wrongful conduct, which is intended to make that victim unavailable for trial. And then if that victim is unavailable for trial, that statement comes in. So I don't think that it's that what we should do is broaden it so great that the underlying conduct in every case can be the conduct or the wrongdoing that that can waive this confrontation clause. I think what you're doing is you're going down a risky road. It's going to be litigated for years in the courts. Now, it may be that Mr. Sylvester wants to have this broad approach and let the courts litigate it out, but I don't think that's a good idea to put that in our statutes. If we don't know that it's going to be constitutional, it's better to take the safe approach and let the courts and let people litigate it on the safe approach rather than taking a broad approach basically reinstituting a DV exception having cases overturned. That's not going to be a good approach for victims because they're not going to know that the conviction is going to be lasting. So I now back 287. I think it's a safe, cautious approach, and I'd ask that you move that bill without the dash two amendments.
Thank you. Did you want to speak as well? Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Gartwin. I'm with the Legal Services Division of the Office of Public Defense Services, and I'm here to testify against the dash two amendment. And I don't know if I even need to get into the merits of what's wrongful and what's not, because I thought Senator Ringo's question was, you know, right on the money, but what is wrongful. But I think I'm going to echo Ms. Skye here a lot, but I think the safer and cautious way to go is to just adopt the federal rule, because the federal rule was referenced, I think, by Justice Scalia. And I think if you asked Mr. Sylvester and Mr. Leninger whether or not the dash two is broader than what Scalia referred to, I think they would say yes. And I don't think it's advisable to adopt an amendment that's going to be broader than what the U.S. Supreme Court said was permissible. I don't think we should be inviting litigation. And I think we're not going to know what exactly the dimensions of this are, of this exception are, because I think if you look at Justice Scalia's opinions in Crawford and in Blakely, what he's doing is returning us back to originalism. What did the Constitution mean back in 1787? And he's looking at common law principles about what the forfeiture by wrongdoing doctrine was. And to adopt something that's going to be broader than that principle will conflict with at least Justice Scalia's view of what the forfeiture by wrongdoing principle constitutionally permits. So, again, the safer, wiser, more advisable course is to adopt the federal rule, which is going to be closer to what the common law principle was. And specific intent, for example, was always a part of the common law principle. And it's not here in the first part of the dash two amendment. Pretty much all I have.
And Sybil, did you have the same basic message here? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I have nothing to add on the technical analysis.
Identify yourself for the record, sorry.
Sorry about that. Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center and the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women. And our interest in this bill is purely from the perspective of the greater accountability that it affords for defendants who have misused their power against victims in society. So we appreciate the stance that either the bill or the dash two amendments take against defendants who have procured a witness's unavailability through wrongdoing. So thank you.
Thank you very much. We can go back to Mr. Sylvester for a second. If we decline to put the dash two amendments in it, do you think that there's any problem with the bill passing constitutional muster and fitting into the Oregon system?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, to answer that question, I think we need to step back a bit, and that is that right now, although the United States Supreme Court in Crawford recognized a forfeiture by wrongdoing exception to the requirement that a defendant has to confront witnesses, the current Oregon law does not have a rule in place that codifies the forfeiture by wrongdoing principle, and as I understand, maybe Professor Reiniger can correct me if I'm wrong, there is no case law, even no case law in Oregon that recognizes this. And so I think that it is important for us, regardless of what we do, to enact in Oregon a forfeiture by wrongdoing rule that will apply. That's number one. Number two, so that, you know, in these kind of cases, there will be a rule that will operate to allow
a trial court to admit evidence when there has been a forfeiture by wrongdoing. Number two, this rule as drafted, it's important to remember, applies both to criminal and civil cases. And so in those situations, in a civil case where there is not a constitutional right of confrontation, this bill will operate to allow a party to offer hearsay statements in which the other party has procured the declarant's unavailability. And I think so it will have a benefit in that context too. Third, right now, under the Crawford decision, it is very unclear what the scope of the exception for forfeiture by wrongdoing is under the federal constitution. And so I think it is a benefit to us to adopt a broader rule and that will, in order to cover the situation in which subsequent case law under Crawford effectively expands the forfeiture by wrongdoing or even just clarifies it to apply in a broader range of cases. If the United States Supreme Court in subsequent cases building on Crawford takes an expansive view of what constitutes forfeiture by wrongdoing, it will be a benefit to us to have a rule in place that captures that. It must be remembered that although this enacts a forfeiture by wrongdoing rule into the evidence code of itself cannot override a defendant's constitutional rights. And so even if evidence may be admissible under this rule, that will not preclude a defendant in an individual criminal case from asserting a confrontation clause objection and saying, even though this rule allows the evidence in, constitutionally I'm entitled to exclude it. And so,
but that would be, such a challenge would be less likely to be successful under the original bill than under the Dash 2, is that?
Madam Chair, that is correct, but on the other hand, it may well be that the federal rule is much more narrow than the U.S. Supreme Court may allow as a matter of the Sixth Amendment or the Confrontation Clause. And so, yes, the federal rule is a conservative approach, and it applies only in a very narrow class of cases, but I'm not sure that it's necessary for this state to take that conservative approach, and it may be beneficial to us in the long run to have a broader rule that would cover conduct that the U.S. Supreme Court in the future may permit states to admit. If that answers your question.
So the question is really a kind of a philosophical question. Do we want to be at the cutting edge of pushing the constitutionality, or do we want to wait and see if someone else pushes it, and then we can broaden it later?
Madam Chair, I think that's a correct summary. One thing to keep in mind, too, about the federal rule is although the other speakers have mentioned the fact that there is a body of case law under the federal rule, it is important to remember that body of case law under the federal rule is all decisions by intermediate courts of appeal, and so it is not the final word, and the U.S. Supreme Court may take a different view. For example, it may say, the U.S. Supreme Court may say eventually that, well, homicide isn't an automatic exception under the federal rule as it is written, although the forfeiture by wrongdoing constitutional principle may be broad enough to cover it. The federal rule as it is written is not, because it requires a showing of specific intent. And so there is a danger of tying us specifically to the federal rule, because the case law that's been developed under the federal rule is as yet still in the process of being resolved.
Thank you, counsel.
Madam Chairman, as a committee, Mr. Sylvester, wouldn't that be the United States Supreme Court interpreting what the federal rule meant by wrongdoing? And if we had similar language as the federal rule, wouldn't that be more persuasive as to what ours meant than if we had different language than the federal rule?
That is correct. But what I'm saying is, and I'm not sure if we're talking past each other here, there is a danger in adopting precisely the federal rule, because as a matter of statutory construction, what we necessarily be doing is adopting the federal rule, I think, as it is currently worded and as the federal cases have interpreted. If the U.S. Supreme Court subsequently adopts a narrowing construction of that rule, that may create problems in the implementation of the rule if we base it on the federal, our current rule based on the federal rule. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question in an intelligible way, but Yeah, what I'm suggesting is that it will be a benefit to us, I think, first off, to clarify the parts of the federal rule that are ambiguous, acquiesce in wrongdoing. If we adopt specific language in our Oregon rule that clarifies those two terms, that will be a benefit to us. I think it also will be a benefit to us if we adopt a more expansive rule, because it will allow for allow our rule to apply if in the future the United States Supreme Court adopts a more broad construction of forfeiture by wrongdoing as an exception to the Confrontation Clause. Does that answer your question?
Sure.
Okay.
Senator Pruszynski.
I guess I'm trying to figure out where we're at on the Dash 2s versus the original. Tim, I'm going to ask you, since I apologize I didn't catch the beginning. I mean, I look at the second component of the Dash 2s as to starting on line 4 where it says, or who engage in, and it continues. I mean, to me, that's the part that we're going to be picking up, and I'm trying to figure out what is it that we are not going to be able to cover that's under the original bill if we leave that out. I understand that even if we keep the original bill as is, we need to, at least from the DOJ's perspective, maybe give some type of guidance or definitions as to what acquiesce might mean as compared to what it may commonly mean. But I'm still trying to figure out why we're not going to be able to get where the department wants us to be there with the original language.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Pruszynski, the concern we have with the original language is that it requires the state or the proponent of evidence, and like I said, this applies in civil cases too, but I will talk as if this were a criminal prosecution in which the state is offering hearsay evidence. The bill as it currently is drafted, the federal rule, would require the state to show that the conduct that the defendant engaged in was done with the specific intent to render the victim, the declarant, unavailable. And the concern that we have is that that may be a very difficult, if not impossible, showing in a lot of cases. For example, in a homicide prosecution, it may be reasonable to assume that if you murder somebody for the purpose of exacting revenge, you are also acting with the intent of rendering them unavailable as a witness. But if you get outside the homicide situation to a situation, for example, where a defendant commits first-degree assault with the intent to cause serious physical injury, and the result of which is that the declarant becomes incapacitated, becomes mentally disabled, and no longer is able to testify as a witness, we may have an impossible, it may be impossible to show that the person engaged in the assault with the intent of rendering the person unavailable. Rather, the defendant could say, well, I engaged in the assault with the intent to hurt him, to cause him injury, but I didn't intend to render him unavailable. And the other example I gave is a situation where you have criminal mistreatment that is designed in order of an elder abuse situation that is designed in order to steal assets from the victim, but as a result of engaging in the criminal mistreatment, you gradually cause the person to become incapacitated or incompetent as a witness. It may be impossible in that sort of case to prove a specific intent to render the person unavailable as a witness. And that's why in the first clause of the Dash 2 amendments, all we would be required to show is that the person engaged in criminal conduct that in fact caused the victim, the declarant, to become unavailable, without being required to show that it was with the specific intent to render him unavailable. The second clause covers the situation where the conduct that you engage in, number one, is wrongful in a general sense, and number two, was in fact caused the declarant to be unavailable, and number three, the conduct was engaged in with the specific intent of rendering the declarant unavailable. And that would cover the situation in which you may be complicit with the declarant and you want to get the declarant out of the country, and so you engage in some conduct that facilitates the person getting out of the country. It may not be bribery, it may not be tampering with the witness, but certainly it was wrongful vis-a-vis the criminal prosecution. and that it in, if it in fact caused the declarant to be unavailable, and you did it with the specific intent of causing the declarant to be unavailable, in that situation, I think equitable principles of, as Professor Reiniger was talking about, should cause the defendant to thereby waive any objection to the declarant not being present. And so that's our intent behind breaking it into two separate clauses. The one, the criminal conduct that in fact causes unavailability without showing any specific intent, and number two, other conduct that is wrongful that was in fact with the specific intent of creating causing the declarant to be unavailable.
Let me just follow up.
Please do.
And I guess, Tom, I'm going to give you a chance, because I really, based on what I'm hearing, I just want to put this on the record as to where we're going, why we need to go there. I know we've covered this the first hearing. I guess refresh my own sense of where we're at, but it would seem to me that the body of law that we're referring to in the case, in the federal cases, should already address some of the issues that Mr. Sylvester has brought up, or it doesn't. And I guess the question is, when you do have a case, an assault one, mm-hmm. where someone is beat up so physically to the point where they are not able to testify, mm-hmm. but they've made a prior statement that this person's said they're going to come after me, mm-hmm. how would the courts handle that, the federal courts, under the federal rule?
Do you mind if I
get over? Thank you, Peter.
Senator Prezonsky, I appreciate that question and the prior question, and if I might just very quickly respond to the prior question because it segues into this. The prior question, where does Dash 2 get us that we don't get with 287? I think that Dash 2 will offer both a hearsay exception as well as the way to surmount the constitutional concern, whereas the original version probably wouldn't offer the hearsay exception, but the constitutional doctrine is what it is, no matter what the legislature decides. So probably what happens in that case where you have conduct that may amount to equitable forfeiture under evolving constitutional law principles, as Ms. Guy said, but doesn't fit the exact language of this statutory hearsay exception, is the prosecutor's got to find another statutory hearsay exception. But when it comes to that final analysis about the Sixth Amendment, then whatever the evolving common law doctrine is would be consulted at that point. Practically what happens in federal court, there are very few simple assault cases in federal court, so that's a hard one to address. But practically what happens is there's a pretrial hearing where the court, outside the presence of the jury, would ask the prosecutor, what did the accused do that you believe amounts to a forfeiture of his right to confront the witness against him? If I were the prosecutor, as I was for 7 years, I would say X, Y, and Z, and the court said, well, you must show me by a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant not only committed those acts, but committed them with the intent to silence the witness, or now, as you pointed out the other day, in a homicide case, it's enough to show intended to commit homicide. And so that's practically what would happen in federal court. You'd have to prove it outside the presence of the jury by a preponderance, and then the jury would be a little suspicious of hearsay, as they always are, so I'm less concerned about the bootstrapping problem. And finally, I just wanted to note that in response to your concerns at the last hearing, the next day I wrote a version of this first one that included the homicide exception, and I really appreciate Mr. Sylvester's work because he ran it by some DAs, and it evolved a bit from there. But that's why we have the two versions, is I think wanting to codify our discussion the other day and bring it to a level where it's useful day-to-day. And he pointed out that sometimes causing incapacity through incompetence or with an elder abuse victim where you don't actually kill the person might be just as egregious as homicide. So I apologize that we haven't tidied this up, but that's why we are where we are.
Okay, you're done. I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, but the broadening is really in the first clause, because you're saying if the effect is to prevent them from coming, then you don't have to make any findings about intent, or you know, that could be part of the original crime. If the original crime just so happens to keep them from coming to trial, then the hearsay exception can apply. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I can answer that. Yes, you are correct. The most broadening part of this is in the first clause when you compare it to the current federal rule, because the first clause says that if you engage in criminal conduct, that automatic, that in fact renders the victim or the declarant unavailable as a witness. That is all that we have to show in order to constitute forfeiture. We don't have to. The federal rule requires the additional showing that the criminal conduct was done with the purpose of silencing the witness, whereas under this draft, we would not have to show, the state would not have to show it was done with the purpose of silencing the witness. Rather, if we show that it was criminal conduct and, in fact, as a result, the victim, the declarant, is unavailable as a witness, either because he's dead, he's incapacitated, or is incompetent, or is outside the jurisdiction of the court, or is hiding, something of that nature, then that is sufficient to constitute forfeiture.
Senator Pazanski.
Thank you. Tim, I want to follow up on that because I'm having some difficulty. When I look at other at that on line 3, it says, as completing otherwise participated in criminal conduct that caused the declarant to be unavailable. If you have a victim, for whatever reason, makes flight, and there's no way or there's no indication that they made flight because of the conduct committed against them by the individual, what's the prosecution going to say? The person's not here, so we get to bring in all the statements? I mean, to me, it's so broad, it almost appears that just because the person's not there, there's no burden on the state to demonstrate that the party who the statement's being brought against actually took part in some type of conduct that caused that person to be unavailable.
Madam Chair, Senator Pazanski, I think that gets caught up in the word that caused. Assuming a criminal prosecution in which we're trying to offer the declarant's hearsay statements against the defendant, we would have to show under this rule both that the defendant committed criminal conduct, number one, and number two, that that criminal conduct in fact caused the declarant to be unavailable. So we don't have to prove merely that there was criminal conduct and that the declarant is unavailable. There's also that third requirement, and that is that the criminal conduct at issue was what caused the declarant to be unavailable. And so if you have a situation where it's a domestic violence sort of situation and the victim does not show up for trial, that of itself isn't enough to get the statement in. Rather, we would have to show that the defendant engaged in some criminal conduct that, in fact, caused that the witness not to be present. Now, if the witness is not present because the witness is dead or incapacitated as a result of the assault, that may be easy. But if the victim declarant is simply just not there, we haven't carried our burden of showing the causal connection between the two. And it may be difficult even in a situation, and I gave you the example earlier about the defendant who engaged in a long series of sexual assaults on a child and always told the child, do not tell anybody or I will kill you or I will kill your mother. If the declarant then is refusing to testify at trial, and the court is finding the victim incompetent, we would still be required to show that it was the conduct of the defendant that caused the declarant to refuse to testify, not merely that there were these two events. And it may be difficult in some cases to prove that causal connection because the court may ask the declarant, why is it that you don't want to testify? And the child may just say, I'm scared. And that may not be enough. And so there is no, I don't think there's a problem under this particular formulation in a court simply saying the declarant isn't here and so therefore the state gets the evidence in. Rather, that particular burden of showing that caused, I think, will be crucial in most cases.
Okay. All right, are there other questions from the committee? I think what I'd like to do here is ask you to take, if you're not just completely sick to death of this, ask you to take another shot at this to narrow it down. I can see some value to having a little bit more provable than the original bill, but to not to make it so that the the elements of the original crime are different from the hearsay exemption. Did you have a comment on that?
I do.
Senator?
Yeah, and when you're looking at this, I guess what I'm going to say, Tim, I know that the word that seems to be catching your concern is the intended on line 15. And I'm wondering if there's not some way of blending in with some of the wording that you use in your dash twos that could maybe cover that and still give comfort to the opponents to the dash two. And I've looked at it. I'm kind of just trying to figure. I mean, if you use the word caused in that scenario there, that probably gets you where you want to be. That may be too broad, but there's got to be a way that we can blend this together and still capture, because I still think that there's value in going to some level with more than what the federal rule has, but I'm very uncomfortable going too far out there without having the surety that we're not putting victims in a position that basically we're going to see these cases come back a second time or a third time. And so I'd rather have something that's a little bit more founded in law, but also maybe giving a little bit more broader perspective. And if we can't find it through what's been proposed with the dash two, then I would ask for some type of understanding that's in the current lines 14 through 16 that would give those exceptions that you want to make certain are preserved there.
Okay.
Counsel?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will suggest that probably we should have some kind of informal recoup. Mm-hmm. I have 9 pages of email notes back and forth, and this is probably somewhere around our fourth or fifth email draft to be encapsulated in the dash two.
Okay, I really concur with the statements of Senator Prezansky. We want to make it not an impossibly high barrier for things that really do call for the hearsay exemption. I'm kind of persuaded that might be too high a barrier. But I really we don't want to broaden it out to consider the original crime as the same thing as an exemption for the hearsay. And I don't know how, I imagine there's some blurring is inevitable, but I think it just needs another tack. So maybe we could form a work group of you all and Council Taylor and Senator Prezansky, if you wanted to participate in that as well. It would be good to use Senator Prezansky as a sounding board for when you come up with something, if you're willing to do that.
I am.
We're all completely pressed for time around here, but that would be very helpful. So thank you all, and thank you again for coming up. I hope you feel better.
Thank you.
Go Ducks. This work session is closed on Senate Bill 287. Now we will open we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 331, and we will carry Senate Bill 331 to tomorrow's meeting. There's a very small amendment that we're going to be considering tomorrow. So now we will close the work session on Senate Bill 331, and we will...
63. Work session 331.
Oh, yeah, that's what I want to do. Open the work session on Senate Bill 330.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 330 comes from the Committee on the Judiciary. It permits court reporter employed by party to change transcript fees as agreed to between the reporter and parties employing the reporter. You have the dash two amendments in front of you, and you also have a hand and gross version of the bill that includes the dash two amendments.
Maybe we could get, is Laura Smith here to explain this to us a little bit more? Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. Can I call up Scott Crampton, too? These are amendments that we worked on together.
Yes, so. I appreciate that.
Thank you. I'll just start really quick, and members of the committee, Madam Chair, my name is Laura Smith. I'm with Dave Barrows and Associates here today representing the Oregon Court Reporters Association. The Dash 2 amendments in front of you incorporate them, and the Dash 1 amendments, which were the Court Reporter Association's first amendments, and they also address the concerns of the Oregon Judicial Department and the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and we would urge your support of them, and I can let Scott talk to you a little bit about his thoughts on it.
For your record, I'm Scott Crampton. I'm the Director of Appellate Court Services for the Oregon Judicial Department.
Oh, can you speak up a little bit? We can't hear
yes.
you.
Yes. The Dash 2 amendments that, that have been proposed do address the Judicial Department's concerns, primarily related to the mechanics of the timing of the agreement and so forth. So I'm available for questions, but we really don't have any other comments.
Okay. It's pretty straightforward here, folks, and it's hand engrossed. Is there any comments by the committee or questions?
Chair, I just have one question. Are the court reporters comfortable with putting a specific cap, $2.50 per cap per page, in legislation so that it can't be changed, or that it requires legislation to change it?
Senator Whitsitt, that $2.50 cap is already there for official court reporters, and yes, they're fine. The official court reporters are fine keeping that cap there. This would only apply to freelance reporters.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Senator Starr, do you have any thoughts on the Dash 2 amendments?
I would like to move Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 330.
Senator Starr. Thank you. Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 330. Is there discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 330 as amended to the floor to be passed.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 330 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Walker, you're just in time to carry Senate Bill 330.
Oh, perfect timing.
331, right?
We got stuff postponed.
We put that till tomorrow, Senator Walker.
Oh, because I had an amendment.
Senator Walker, we just got stuff 330.
So 330, Madam Chair, I needed to put a potential conflict of interest on the record on 330, I think.
We will reopen the work session on Senate Bill 330. Senator Walker.
Yes, Madam Chair, I need to put on the record a potential conflict of interest. I do not work in circuit court as a rule, but who knows, someday I might as a court reporter, and I could be impacted by this bill.
Okay. Senator Walker, while we are on the back in work session, would you like to vote on Senate Bill 330?
Oh, yes, I'd be delighted to. I know that I caught my breath. I would vote aye.
Senator Walker votes aye. I think she already did, but it was a little ambiguous. Okay. So, Senator Walker, you are carrying Senate Bill 331.
330.
Excuse me. 331 will be tomorrow, and we will look forward to seeing your amendment.
Okay. It's at your desk.
Okay. Let's see. Now, we will move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 946. Council. Trying to keep counsel on its
feet. Madam Chair, let me start off that.
I keep getting these gender
changes. This does have referral to Ways and Means Committee, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
According to my files.
Which bill?
It requires a judge to order a report of proceedings in aggravated murder case be done by a court reporter, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary.
Thank you. And we have a sign-up sheet on that. If I can find it, I know Paul Snyder is signed up. Okay, we have Laura Smith and Mary Fagan from the Court Reporters Association. Why don't you go ahead and start?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura Smith with A. Barrows and Associates here with the Oregon Court Reporters Association today, and I brought with me our Court Reporters Association's Legislative Chair, Ms. Mary Fagan. She's an official court reporter with Marion County, and she's here to talk to you today about 946.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify with regard to Senate Bill 946. The Oregon Court Reporters Association strongly supports the passage of this bill. According to the National Center for State Courts...
Excuse me, could we get your name for the record?
Sure, I'm sorry. Mary Fagan.
Thank you. Proceed. Sorry for the interruption.
Sure. According to the National Center for State Courts, making an accurate and complete record of court proceedings is an important goal for the courts. A single word error in transcripts has a potential to cause great harm. In many of Oregon's courts, stenographic court reporters have historically been the guardians of the record and produce an accurate and complete record for transcripts on appeal. The budget crisis and implementation of the Court Operations Budget Reduction Plan in 2003 resulted in the loss of approximately 40 out of 50 official court reporter positions statewide. An interim work group met in 2004 and discussed the merits and shortcomings of the electronic recording devices versus certified shorthand court reporters. Failures and problems with the electronic recording devices were noted, particularly on murder and aggravated murder cases, wherein the quality of the transcripts were affected. Case in point, the Christian Longo murder trial in Lincoln County, where he received the death penalty, that was recorded utilizing a digital system. The transcriptionist made public claims that the judge's mic was hanging in the ozone somewhere and was difficult to hear most of the time. Also, the attorneys have the ability to turn off the mics at counsel tables so that private conversations can't be heard. And what happened was 90% of the defense, anything that happened at their portion of the table did not come through very audibly because their mic was turned off. The state's mic was turned off 50% of the time. One of the defense counsel was later contacted by this transcriptionist to see if they could help her make sense of the transcript and certain portions of the transcript. Also of note, there was a 5-day bench trial, a civil trial here in Marion County utilizing digital system, and only one of the 5 days was recorded. It resulted in a mistrial. Months later, went to a 2-week jury trial, and now several of the litigants from that matter have filed suit against the state to recoup the relitigation expenses. The use of a certified stenographic reporter who is capable of producing instant voice-to-text translation of the proceedings would translate into savings for the Judicial Department. That reporter would be able to go ahead and give to counsel a rough draft daily transcript of the proceedings for counsel to review on a word search basis. It would eliminate the potential for trial or mistrial, and it would, which would be due to equipment malfunction if you would otherwise use digital. And it would eliminate the need for appellate counsel on review to have to deal with inaudible or unintelligible parentheticals. The Oregon Court Reporters Association believes that certified stenographic court reporters will ensure an accurate and complete record, promote the efficient administration of justice, and preserve the fundamental rights of the people of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it fair to say, and maybe I should be asking my colleague, Senator Walker, this, but since I have you here, I'll ask you here. If there's an equipment malfunction or something goes wrong with a live reporter, do they see that right away?
Yes, ma'am, and actually most reporters have several backups. We have our stenographic paper notes. You have the proceedings, which are electronically imprinted on a hard drive on our steno machines. Most reporters nowadays, I'd say 99% of reporters, utilize computer-aided transcription. And when the reporter is also writing live voice-to-text translation, they have the backup on the computer system.
So one of those systems is very much like the digital system that the court uses, that the digital transcription, is that what you said?
Well, the digital system is an audio, capturing the audio on the hard drive.
So in that case, for that part of the backup, they'd have the same problem that the court had in the Longo case where people turn off their mics?
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
But you have a couple of layers, so you're not depending on that. Is that what you're saying?
With the stenographic court reporter, yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, thank you. Because the stenographic reporter is the one taping it down with his or her fingers, and they know when they're not listening, when they can't hear, and so they can interrupt the proceedings. Also, our machines, as Ms. Fagan testified, most of us are computer-aided. I don't know anyone who isn't. And there's a disk, just like a floppy disk that goes in your computer at home. It goes into our court reporting machine. It records on the paper tape as well as on the disk. And then you take it back to your computer and you plug in the disk and it translates into English language. So we see the computer lights on our machine moving. We see the paper moving. And we're also the ears and the eyes of the courtroom. So for a court reporter to screw up and not be turned on would be very difficult to do.
So what I'm trying to get at is if somebody leaves their mic off, like at the defense table, that doesn't affect a court reporter the way it does the digital recording?
Correct, Madam Chair, because we are listening to them speak. We're not taping it through a microphone or into a tape recorder. So, and if we can't hear what defense counsel is saying, it's our duty to say, excuse me, could you repeat that, or could you slow down, which we say a lot, or could you enunciate? I mean, that's our job. We're the eyes and ears of the courtroom.
Thank you very much. Is there any other questions here? Senator Whitsitt.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Fagan, given the financial status of our court system, would it be safe to predict that the courts already paying for a court reporter may stop paying for a reporter, thereby shifting their expense to the counties and the defense services?
May I answer that? I'm not sure that I totally understand. I'm sorry, Senator Whitsitt. Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we do have some amendments that are being drafted on this bill, and it says, and the amendments state that if there's no official court reporter, then this bill would kick in. But if there is an official court reporter, as there is in Marion County and down in Lane County, then those court reporters would just be required to be on murder trials. They're already assigned to murder trials for the most part, I believe, if there are official reporters. Reporters in the county. Is that correct, Mary? In your county?
Yes. I guess the question was, would it encourage those courts that are currently using their funds to employ a reporter to no longer do that because this law would require the reporter to be hired by a different source of funding?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I believe it would be actually a good question for presiding judges because it is up to them. And I know that those presiding judges that have retained their reporters over all these years really do highly value having official court reporters instead of having to have freelancers come in. They really value their court reporters and have really struggled and sacrificed many other things to keep their court reporters on. So, as I said, that would be a good question for them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Now we will talk to Paul Snyder and Scott Crampton. Welcome. You can decide who goes first here. You both signed down as a post. Why don't you start, Mr.
Go ahead. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Warden Counties, and I share the concern that Senator Whitsitt has raised, and we'll take it a little bit farther than that. The primary concern that counties have with respect to this legislation is financial. And looking at the fiscal that was put together by the Judicial Department, if I read it correctly, and I'm not sure I do, that the fiscal impact over a period of, I think, 3 years, because it seems to cover calendar years 2001 to 2004, the fiscal impact of this bill would be $1 million. And in addition to that, we don't know the answer to Senator Whitsitt's question as to whether or not that would be an aggravating factor to actually increase the costs even beyond what the fiscal impact would show. Madam Chair, in 1981, the state took over the operating costs of the court system, and there were a number of divisions that were made of responsibilities between the state and the counties. And this aspect, in terms of paying for the cost of providing these services, I believe was to have been assumed by the Judicial Department, and the Judicial Department has carried that expense up until now, and including now. I haven't heard in any of the testimony by the proponents what the rationale is for shifting this cost to counties. And I would just simply emphasize to the committee that with measures 5 and 47 and 50 and looking at today's capital clips talking about the biscuit fire and the difficulty of harvesting timber, there are a large number of counties that are hanging on by their fingernails just hoping that the federal government will reauthorize the safety net legislation, and if that doesn't happen, those counties are going to be in very bad financial shape. We've suffered, as the state has, over several biennia of budget cuts, and we've had to deal with a number of them of our own, even before the ones that the state has started to go through. So my concern, Madam Chair, is several fold. I don't know what the rationale is for charging the counties for these costs, or for the counties getting back into the business of recruiting, hiring, and doing RFPs for court reporters. The fiscal cost to the counties, as I suppose would also be the case with the state, would be that it would probably translate into a loss of services somewhere else to the extent that it's a new cost to us. And those are our concerns, Madam Chair.
Okay, I'm a little puzzled because we have no fiscal. I'm wondering how you were able to get a fiscal on this one.
Well, Madam Chair, it was a courtesy. It was sent to us by the Judicial Department.
Council.
Oh, Madam Chair, I've never received a copy of that.
Maybe we can ask Mr. Crampton why we did not get a copy of the fiscal, since that seems pretty relevant to this discussion.
Madam Chair, with leave of the committee, I'd like to call up Monica Melhorn from the Judicial Department, who worked on this with the Office of Public Defense Services Commission. I believe it's actually their fiscal impact statement.
Okay, just in terms of future reference, it's really good to provide these things to the committee if people are going to be testifying about them.
I understand.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Monica Melhorn. I am with the Office of the State Court Administrator. The information that Mr. Snyder is referring to was not in a fiscal impact statement of ours. It was data that an analysis that I had put together that I did give to the Public Defense Services Commission, and as a courtesy also provided to Mr. Snyder. I believe that Public Defense Services did attach it as an exhibit to their fiscal impact statement that I don't believe went, it may not have gone to legislative fiscal office quickly enough for it to have made its way here. I don't know what the status is of that. It's not part of our fiscal because those costs of that are included in the information I gave to Mr. Snyder are not ours, but they included information on number of hearings scheduled on these kinds of cases, the location of those, number of trials held, that kind of information, a whole bunch of suppositions because it wasn't totally clear to us what all those costs might be.
Okay, well, we have, people who've worked. If you're handing out material like this that's relevant to a bill, it would be good to send it to the people who support the bill as well as those who oppose it, so everybody can be working off of the same page.
I apologize, Chair. This was not available until Friday. It is something I spent a significant amount of time putting together, and I apologize that I didn't get a chance to get
to
everybody.
And not others, so in the future, if you could make sure, if you're distributing something, that it gets to both sides. Senator Pruzanski.
Thank you. I want to go back in history. Who paid for these services when we had live reporters in the rooms? Back in the old days, before we went electronic, we had court reporters. Who was shouldering that? Was that the Judicial Department or was it the counties?
Chair Burdick, Senator Pruzanski, the official reporters were part of the Oregon Judicial Department and were paid as employees of the Judicial Department.
Right.
As the ones that still are there
are still there in Lane County, Marion County, are part of the Judicial Department.
Yeah, that is correct.
Okay.
That's it.
That's all I need to know.
Thank you.
I mean, that, Madam Chair, I mean, it tells me where the court costs should be. I mean, what I see here, and, you know, I'm going to get my soapbox, we're basically trying to be more efficient with time. We're trying to cut the cost. And what we're doing is we're basically setting up records that are not perfected, that can't be used in an appeal, and we have to retry the case. And the victims in these cases have to relive the thing over again. Something is wrong with this picture. And in the murder cases where we got mandatory minimum sentences of 25 years plus, and we got all the other components to it, we should get it right the first time. We shouldn't be playing around with this two or three times, because it messes up a lot of people's lives, including the victims that have to go through this two or three times. Sorry.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay, Mr. Crampton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For your record, I'm Scott Crampton, the Director of Appellate Court Services for the Oregon Judicial Department. Although this bill does identify the costs for the reporters to be shared between the counties and the Public Defense Services Commission, the bill also raises some mechanical questions that concern the Judicial Department. They're primarily the uncertainty or clarity as to who's responsible for some of the coordination that would be required under this bill. For example, the bill does not address who's responsible for obtaining the court reporting services, scheduling the reporters, ensuring that the reporters are in fact qualified to perform the tasks at hand, who's responsible for canceling services if a hearing or trial is canceled, the billing, auditing, and payment functions associated with it, and the effect on a hearing or a trial if qualified reporters are not available or become unavailable during the proceeding. Because the court is responsible for the court record and responsible for scheduling matters before the court and ensuring that resources are necessary in the courtroom, we assume that the burden for most of these items that are not addressed in the bill would in fact fall on the courts. We've had significant experience managing court services programs such as the interpreter program, and the department has found that centralized coordination of services is more effective and efficient than having each court search for services independently. This is because of the need to make sure that there's a schedule of rates that are uniformly administered, the need to ensure that qualified reporting services are available, the lack of such services in many areas of the state, particularly rural areas, and the unpredictable rate of filings. The department is merely seeking clarification on who is responsible for coordinating some of these services that are here. It's unclear for us as to who that is at this point. We understand there's some Dash 1 amendments that may shift responsibilities for coordinating to away from the Judicial Department. If that total responsibility is clearly shifted, our potential impact to the Judicial Department would merely be any potential delay that's caused by the unavailability of reporting services. However, if this was not the intended change, then the Department may have some material coordination and resource costs. I'll be happy to answer any questions about our position.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to also refer you to the Dash 1 amendments and the engrossed version of the bill, and the engrossed version with the Dash 1 amendments.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pazansky.
I'm going to tell you, there's no way I'm going to support the Dash 1s. The Dash 1s are an unfunded mandate. I mean, this is, we're gone full circle. I mean, maybe it's my age, my tenure here in the legislature, but the reality is we spun off a lot of the obligations that were within the state system of the counties. I think Mr. Snyder's points are well taken. And now basically what we're trying to do, in my opinion, if we bring back the service that was there as a state obligation, we're going to ask the counties to now pay, if it's true, $1 million to cover the cost. I mean, clearly, for my support, this needs to have a new set of amendments that puts the responsibility back where it's supposed to be, and that's to the State Judicial Department. Let it go down the Ways and Means, they get budgeted in or not, and let them deal with it. But passing it around, I mean, I sit here and I look at what we're going to do. If you have a person who has been charged with murder, first if they're in the public defender system, we're going to have the state's that budget paid for half of it under what I see here, and the other half going to the counties, or it could go to the Judicial Department. And if it's not, if you got someone that's rich enough to be able to provide their own counsel, then does that mean they have to pay for their own court reporter? I mean, the burden on the state is we have the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt and be able to take it not only through the trial but all the way through the appellate process. This is a burden that we as a state have, and we should retain it and not pass it to the counties or to individuals.
Okay, thank you, Senator Pruszynski. What I'm trying to determine here is whether the original bill does leave that in the judicial department.
It does not. The original.
Counsel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the issue of cost in this bill is on line 25, page 1. The defendant or the Public Services Defense Commission, if the defendant has appointed counsel, shall pay half the cost of the reporter services required by paragraph A of this subsection. Mm-hmm. The county, in this case, shall pay the remaining half. Both sides, both the district attorney and the defense counsel, will use this transcript. And I think what it came out of the work group, Senator Walker chaired the informal work group during the interim, was that since they both use it, you should both pay half the cost.
If that's true, what if the defendant is not represented by the Public Defender Services Commission? Who pays for that half then?
Then the defendant or the Public Defense Service Commission, if the defendant has appointed counsel, so the defendant will pay for his half.
I mean, so now we're saying for someone that's been only charged with a crime, for them to get a perfected record that they could always use in the future if they were found guilty, first of all, if they're found guilty, they're going to have to basically pay for that service, just like they have to do when they hire counsel, which, you know, if they can afford it, you know, great for them. But the reality, what happens if they are found to be not guilty? That's the cost of defending yourself?
But right now, the courts that have reporters are paid for by the judicial department.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
That's how it was, Madam Chair, before we start spinning off these services and going to all the electronics. I can understand, as a prosecutor, when you have these low-level type of offenses where that might be appropriate. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about potentially life and death, you know, we as a state have a certain burden that we have to be obligated to. And we can't, I mean, it's just ironic that we're basically taking something that was done very simple, very straightforward, and now we're looking at whose other budgets in the state system. I mean, it's still going to come from the same money. It's just whose budget is it going to come out of?
Well, in the case of the defendant who doesn't have counsel, you know, state-paid counsel, then it comes out of their private budget, the person accused of the crime. So I agree with Senator Pruszynski, and I think we should have an amendment drafted at least for us to consider to put it in the judicial department on the same basis as the judicial department pays for court reporters. And then when it goes to Ways and Means, they have all kinds of flexibility on who should pay for what.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I could. The judicial department doesn't want to pay for this. They don't want court reporters, and I think we've made it clear why we need court reporters in these cases especially. You know, counties can make their own individual decisions about whether they want them for other cases, but these are critical, as Senator Pruszynski eloquently put it. Everyone keeps shirking their responsibility here, and so we couldn't come to any agreement in the work group, and this is the product, and you're right, this isn't fair. And people just need to realize that we need to have court reporters. What Mr. Crampton didn't tell you, because no one asked him the question, is there is no certification process for these people who run the audio equipment. And that's why you have equipment that doesn't turn on. There's no training. And I was appalled about that and said, you know, come on, if you're going to have audio reporters, then they should be trained. And it's just really frightening to see what's become of our judicial system, and it's a money issue. It comes down to a money issue.
Well, I think we need to do the best we can with this bill. I think our job as a judiciary committee is to make a decision on the policy end of it, which is whether there should be court reporters, live court reporters, in these very serious criminal trials. And the ways, as I understand the process, the Ways and Means Committee, we'll do the best we can, but the Ways and Means Committee will be the ultimate decision maker on who pays. I think it's our job to take our best shot at who should pay, determined by what we think is right, but at the end of the day, the Ways and Means Committee will determine whose budget this comes out of. So, Council, did you have a comment?
Madam Chair, no, just clarification. You'd like an amendment to the bill that would, I take it, would amend down on lines
25.
Lines 19 through 24, and I take it, excuse me, lines 25 through 28, and you'd like the amendment to say that the Judicial Department shall pay for the transcript, and that's regardless of whether the defendant is injured or not. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, thanks.
And we'll have that as an option, and we'll see, you know, we'll see what people consider. What I don't understand, because I haven't looked at the Hannon Gross thoroughly, the Dash 1 amendment does other stuff as well, and I'm having trouble.
Madam Chair, I think the main thing that the Dash 1 amendments do at lines 8 through 10, the county shall select stenographic reporting services required by paragraph A of this subsection through a competitive bidding process. So
well,
that would be, I believe, the main thing, give a responsibility to them on that.
Okay.
I assume that it's not amending those lines we just mentioned, lines 25 through 27, so it would still be the responsibility of the Public Defense Service Commission or the defendant, if the defendant is able to do so, and the county to pay half the cost. But it gives to the counties the responsibility of retaining the...
Okay, so the question is, if we're going to have an amendment to have the Judicial Department pay for it, whether they should be the ones who select it.
So, Madam Chair, looking at the Dash 1 amendments in line up where it says counties, you want to insert the Judicial Department? So the Judicial Department shall select stenographic reporting services required by paragraph A of the subsection through a competitive bidding process?
Why do we even need a competitive bidding process?
Because they're probably not going to bring people on full-time into the counties mm-hmm. to be there all the time. Because you think about it, we're talking about murder cases. I don't know how many we have in the state, but you know, each county does not have a murder case.
Well, that's
year.
Correct. I just wonder why we have to say a competitive. No. I mean, wouldn't they kind of do that naturally?
Well, they probably would put it out to bid.
Yeah.
Just cause.
Chair, Klamath County doesn't have live court reporters, haven't had them for years, and so there wouldn't be a court reporter there for them to choose from, so that's why they want to do a competitive bidding process.
I think the chair just wants to know if we actually need to put in the statute that has to be through a competitive bid process.
Because if they only have one court reporter down there, whether that would, you know, I don't know, availability. Council, do you
I'm sure some of the counties do currently keep court reporters, so maybe going once again to the Dash 1 amendments, so the Judicial Department shall select stenographic reporting services required by paragraph A of this subsection, and then period.
Yeah,
the other thing I was going to mention to council is that when you're going through the changes from lines 25 through 28, I would think that lines 29 through page 1 to line 1 probably are not necessary, because you're not going to have that transferring of cost from one county to another county.
Right.
There's also, Madam Chair, some additional changes in the Dash 1 amendment that I think are appropriate on line 21. The judge shall order a report of, that's being replaced by, shall order a stenographic reporter for the proceedings.
Right. That's what I was trying to get at, is what else the
right. And then also on that line, the reporter shall make a report, that should be changed to record, and that's in the amendment. Mm-hmm. And then you'll see that also on line 23.
Mm-hmm. Maybe Senator Walker could sit down with counsel, since she's pretty familiar with, you know, the process for court reporters, and just make sure the Dash 2s get what we need in it.
Would you be willing to do that in your spare time, Cindy?
I will make a spare time. I don't have it. I'll just take it out of one of my other committees.
Thank you very much. I will have so much more confidence if you're involved in it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 9946. And we will open something here. We will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 567, brought to us by Senator Prozanski. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 567 creates the offense of a failure to properly secure child punishes it by a maximum fine of $180, creates the offense of failure to secure a child, punishable by a maximum fine of $720. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this differs from current law mainly in the sense that it sets forth new penalties and redefines what it moves out of one general provision as it relates to CPLs and creates new separate provisions with higher fines.
Senator Prusansky, do you have any comments on this bill?
I do. I guess I'm going to ask if Trooper Swift might be able to join us, since this was put together at the request of the Oregon State Police Officers Association.
That's terrific. And maybe we could have Joanne Fairchild from Trauma Nurses Talk Tough.
Basically, what we're trying to do is establish that where you have parents who attempt to do the right thing that may not fully accomplish it, that they should be held to one standard for a failure to properly secure a child in the restraint apparatus that they have, as compared to someone who just blows off the restraints completely and puts a kid at more of a risk and peril because they didn't even take the opportunity to, one, either have the restraints or to place the child within the restraints, even though they may be improperly restrained.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Trooper Swift, do you want to start?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Daniel Swift. I am employed as a state trooper for the state of Oregon. I'm also currently president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. The OSPOA represents the sworn troopers, forensic scientists, and dispatchers who daily provide the point of service of Oregon law enforcement to our communities. I am here today to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 567, which is definitely needed to help protect the most vulnerable of all Oregonians, our children. Fortunately, Oregon has one of the highest compliant rates in the nation for seatbelt and child safety restraint usage. Unfortunately, there is still a segment of the population that insists on putting their children at risk for death or serious injury every time they operate an automobile. Senate Bill 567 is directed squarely at that negligent parent. Under current law, failure to place a child on any kind of restraint device carry the same penalties as using a child restraint device, but doing so improperly. Senate Bill 567 would change that, and it is very important that we as a state make such a distinction. Clearly, we need to distinguish between what's basically an error of omission, such as a Class D violation, versus negligence, which could result in serious injury or death, as a Class A violation. In addition to all my normal duties as a state trooper, I am also an accident reconstructionist for the department. In fact, I'm only one of 14 troopers currently holding such a certification within the Department of State Police. As such, I have seen, more than even most police officers, firsthand the damage and injuries the human body can sustain when unrestrained and even a low-speed impact. In simple terms, if a car is going 15 miles per hour, comes to a sudden and abrupt stop, the unsecured occupants inside that vehicle continue forward at 15 miles per hour until they strike an object large enough to stop them. If they are lucky, it will be something relatively soft, such as the back of a seat. If they aren't lucky, it will be the front dashboard or the windshield. Let me put this in perspective. If a parent were to deliberately pick up their infant child and throw them against a wall in their home at 15 miles per hour, no one in this room would think twice about sending that parent to the state penitentiary for a very long time. Now, I am not trying to equate failing to use a child seat with an intentional criminal act of child abuse, but the injuries the children in both scenarios will sustain are going to be almost identical. Failure to use any restraint devices at all to protect your children is negligence, pure and simple. In closing, I'm going to relate a true story which happened to me while I was still on patrol. I was on patrol one afternoon on 82nd Avenue near the Johnson Creek Boulevard area of Clackamas County when I noticed an SUV next to me. I noticed it because I saw what turned out to be a three-year-old infant crawling from the far back of the SUV into the middle seat and then over into the front passenger seat. Once in the front passenger seat, they then returned from the front passenger seat to the middle to the back of the car. On the return trip, they were followed by their six-year-old brother. Needless to say, I stopped this SUV and I contacted the mother, who was the driver of the automobile. During this contact, I noticed a perfectly functional child restraint seat properly set up in the rear seat where it should have been. When I explained why I was stopping her and I asked her why her kids were not properly restrained in the vehicle, this is the response I got. "Well, officer, if you want them to sit still, then you come in here and make them, because they won't listen to me." Members of this committee, this attitude is the type of negligence that kills and injures our children. And that parent is the reason we in the law enforcement community desperately need this bill to become law. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Burdick and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Joanne Fairchild. I'm a trauma nurse coordinator at responsible for injury prevention at Legacy Emanuel Hospital. I also am the director of the Trauma Nurses Talk Tough Injury Prevention Program. I also have run my testimony, my request by the Oregon Safe Kids Coalition, of which I am the chair of the legislative committee. And on my way in here today, I saw Dr. Jim Lace, who is a pediatrician in Salem, who is on my committee, who said you can also say that you represent the Oregon Pediatric Society. So I'm wearing big hats today. I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 567. I agree with the officer that parents who transport their children completely unrestrained should have higher fines than somebody who is at least trying. I used to, when I saw children unrestrained, roll down my window and try to say politely to the parent, I'm a trauma nurse, I know you love your children, please restrain them. Some women almost ran into a telephone pole flipping me off, so I don't do that anymore, but I would really appreciate if these parents got some appreciation for what they were doing. My concern is that many of Oregon's children live in poverty, and although I think the majority of parents in the state can give up one of their vices for a couple of months to save for a child safety seat, I do work with some families who are between my child in a seat or food on my table. So I'm asking that the revenue being raised by this bill be directed to the Child Safety Seat Resource Center through ODOT Transportation Safety Division, specifically for the purchase of child safety seats for low-income families and to support public education regarding child passenger safety. Appropriate child passenger safety laws are important for at least three reasons, and I've attached, actually I got them from some of the research, they were so good. First, they are one of the most effective mechanisms for increasing correct restraint use. Second, 9 out of 10 people, parents, and I see this all the time in our safety belt classes, they believe that if their children are riding legally, they're restrained safely, which in our state isn't quite true. And third, most parents are in favor of expanded legislation so that they understand what appropriate and safe restraints are. For these reasons, I'm asking you to amend this bill to correct several problems with Oregon's existing law about proper restraint use for children, and I've attached the research articles that support this. One is to change, and I won't go through the subsections, it's in my written testimony, but to expand our booster bill to cover what all the research shows is appropriate, that boosters be for children from 4 to 8 years of age and 80 pounds, or 4'9", since there are some children who get to 80 pounds and that are much too tall for child safety seats. So NHTSA suggests it be 4'9". And then there are some other conditions, since I don't expect officers are going to run around with tape measures or scales, that the child is sitting straight with their back against the seat, that their child's knees bend at the... What happens with our children, they have very short legs and we have long legs. And the seats in our cars are designed for us. So to have your lap belt fit appropriately where it belongs, way down here where your body bends, you don't have guts that can pop, and your bones are nice and strong, you have to have your bottom all the way back in the seat and then pull that thing tight. Well, for our little guys under the age of 8 with their very short legs, with their bottom all the way back in the seat, their legs are now sticking straight out in front of them. They don't get to the edge of the seat where they can bend their knees. So what they do is loosen up their lap belt so they can scooch forward, and now the lap belt's going to come right across their midsection, breaking their back and popping their intestinal contents.
as is clear on the article that I've attached called The Forgotten Child. They get severe abdominal injuries, and it's felt that they need to be at least 8 and 80 pounds or 4'9". I'm also asking to delete the exemption in our law for extra people in the car, which allows people to take more children than they have belts and have the extra children totally unrestrained. And under our law, that's legal, which is just nuts to me. It just doesn't make any sense. And additional people that aren't buckled down become missiles through the cars, too, in a crash. I tell kids all the time, you don't want to get killed by flying friends and family members, so please don't ride in vehicles with people who don't buckle up. And the last has to do with what we've known for a while, but it was actually now in a peer-reviewed journal just hot off the presses that shows that all of our children under the age of 13, airbags or not, should be rear seating. The rear seat is much safer for all of us because of head-on crashes, but particularly for children under the age of 13. So thank you very much for your consideration of these amendments to this bill to keep our children safe. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions?
Questions?
I appreciate the differentiation between people who mean to secure their children. Well, I remember when my daughter was 6, I always had the booster seat. I always had her buckled in, and I specifically went out and got a car with airbags because I thought that would be safer for her. And little did I know that.
Right. I've said in my last paragraph, I can't promise you that I won't be back in future sessions asking for more changes. The research comes out all the time that indicates how our children should be buckled in. Since we only have session every 2 years, I have to kind of save up. And
thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? I think what we'll do is I'll have a conversation with Senator Brzezinski and see if he wants to use the bill as a vehicle, or whether we'll send a clean bill and perhaps look for another vehicle for the more substantive amendments that you suggest.
Thank you very much, Chair Burdick and Senator Brzezinski.
We'll now close the hearing on Senate Bill 567. And our last item of business is a hearing on Senate Bill 549. Do we still have our long-suffering witnesses? I really apologize. We thought we'd have plenty of time for this, but that hasn't been the case. So we will very quickly open a public hearing on Senate Bill 549.
Madam Chair, I have to chair a committee, so I'm sorry I'm late.
Okay, thank you. Actually, I think what I'll do is, before I will close temporarily the hearing on Senate Bill 549, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 599 for purposes of transferring 599, moving 599 to tomorrow's Judiciary Committee meeting. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 599. Open the hearing on Senate Bill 549. Thank you. We have Carlos Cartledge and Bonnie Chalmers who have come up here from Lane County. And, Council, if you could just very quickly summarize
that. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 549 requires host organizations. Those are organizations that sponsor foreign students, primarily in our high schools. In fact, I've been the host family twice, to register with the Department of Education and meet certain requirements.
Thank you. And again, I apologize for having to shorten your presentation. We did have a similar bill last session, and so I wanted to open the public hearing today primarily to get your written testimony and a very brief summary. So if you could identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carlos Cartledge. I better spell it Cartledge. I'm a resident of Eugene. I was a parole officer, parole and probation officer for the state for 25 years. During the last 3 years of my parole officer career, I supervised sex offenders exclusively. My wife and I have also been hosts to foreign exchange students for 19 years. I'm here representing myself. This is actually the fourth legislative session I've brought this measure to the committee. Senator Peter Courtney was kind enough after the last session to write a letter encouraging me to bring it back. During the time that my wife and I have hosted foreign students, we've been visited in our home exactly twice by representatives of the host organizations. During my 3-year period supervising sex offenders, I ran into 5 cases where pedophiles had been recruited by host organizations to and been accepted to host foreign students. I knew that most of the people who volunteer to be hosts are good people, but this was alarming to me. I called FBI Quantico and asked to hear if they had statistics on these incidents, and they said they'd been, the special agent in charge told me that they'd been hearing anecdotal evidence from all over the United States, but the FBI kept no statistics on that particular crime. The main feature of this bill, and there is an amendment to require a criminal history check on the applicants to host foreign students. Now, there's various ways to do that. You know, if the host organizations do that, if they're required to do that, there's a database available to them, which most states participate in, and it costs about 75 cents per name to provide these checks. But a higher standard of check, which I would suggest, is require the Department of Education to conduct the same checks that they do on teachers and school staff and bus drivers. Now, criminal history checks won't detect all the people who would abuse or neglect or sexually offend these kids. It's not an end in itself, but the value of criminal history checks are well known to the law enforcement community. It's a way to prevent crime. Now, last week I received a emailed results of some research done by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. I passed that out. Some of the findings are just astounding. 8% of the applicants were just not acceptable candidates to volunteer for kids programs. By the way, they sampled volunteers for a variety of kids programs, not just host organizations. That's what this research was about. And it's astounding to me that 54% of the people who applied to volunteer in these kids programs denied that they had a criminal history, but in fact one was found, maybe not disqualifying, but a criminal history was found. The other astounding information was that 27% of applicants had a record in a different state than where they applied to volunteer. 8.5% of applicants showed a different name on their record than the ones they used to apply. 6% of applicants applied with a different date of birth than showed up in their criminal history. And again, 53.4% of applicants indicated they did not have a record, but one was uncovered.
Thank you, and we do have your written testimony. We need you to kind of summarize because we're out of time and we're losing everybody except me and Senator Starr. So, like I say, we did consider this bill before, and we will take another look at it this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much.
Is Bonnie Chalmers in the audience? Did you have written testimony?
I do.
Would you be willing to submit that for the record? And again, with my apologies, why don't you introduce yourself for the record and just express your support, and then we'll move on.
Okay. For the record, Chair and committee members that are still here, my name is Bonnie Chalmers, and I have worked with exchange organizations for about the past 15 years. I am currently the area coordinator for the state of Oregon for ASSE, International Exchange Student Program, and I did want to give my support for the intent of this bill. I think the safety of our kids is extremely important. I also support the concept that host organizations be responsible to screen, select, monitor host families. But I don't see that this bill would provide any more safety than what is currently being done through the federal programs that oversee and have oversight of the exchange organizations. The schools that I work with require programs to be involved with the federal programs, and those federal programs do offer the support that I think this bill is asking for. I wasn't aware of the criminal history amendment, so my testimony doesn't speak to that. But I do ask the committee to consider the oversight already given by the federal programs. And I have given copies of both the State Department and CSIET's standards and regulations for your review with my written testimony. So again, I thank you.
Thank you for summing up so quickly. I appreciate it. We will take this under advisement, and for the moment we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 549, and we will move open a public hearing on Senate Bill 645 and move that to tomorrow's meeting and close the hearing on Senate Bill 645. Thank you. Senate Judiciary is adjourned. I think we're headed to 98.